Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. So what if Bill Belichick hadn't benched Malcolm Butler? 4 months after a Super Bowl loss to the Eagles, it's still the talk of Patriots Nation and Boston's talk radio. Here's WEEI's Trenny Kuznarek.
You made a move during the Super Bowl that cost your team a Super Bowl. I don't know. I mean, call me crazy, but I feel like there should be some sort of explanation.
There are plenty of other what-if moments in sports. What if Billie Jean King lost to Bobby Riggs? What if baseball teams only played once a week? This hour on Point, upon further review, the greatest what-ifs in sports history. You can join us on air or online. What's your what-if moment in sports? The game change that could have changed it all for your favorite team or athlete. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, soccer star Abby Wambach tells Barnard College graduates to not just be grateful and to fight for what they're worth. But first, what if moments in sports? Joining me now from New York is Mike Pesca, host of Slate's podcast The Gist and author of the new book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mike Pesca, great to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Ray.
So you assemble this all-star team of writers, and already with an idea of what you'd want to have them weigh in on, or do you go fishing and say, come up with your what-if for me?
There were a couple different ways I did it. First, I would reach out to the brilliant and say, be brilliant. So a couple examples of that. Nate DiMeo, who does the Memory Palace podcast, said, Nate, might you want to do a book of what ifs? And before the F is out in if, he says, yes, what if the tug of war were still in the Olympics? Now, the reason I hit up Nate, who, if you listen to podcasts and public radio, you know is a genius, is that he did a fake book about the TV show Parks and Rec. The cover, it says it's written by Leslie Knope. It wasn't. It was written by Nate and a couple other guys. So he's really good at historical fakery, and he brings that to the chapter. Same thing with Stefan Fatsis, of who wrote Word Freak and is also a podcaster on Hang Up and Listen. Hey, Stefan, you want to do what-ifs? I've always wanted to ask, what if Bucky Dent hadn't homered over the Green Monster? So Nate does his essay with footnotes and like a fake entry into the history of the Olympics. Stefan does his essay in very memoir form. Of the 31 essays and the intro by Malcolm Gladwell, we have all different sports and all different forms and all different ways of attacking it. With some of my contributors, I reached out to Michael McCambridge, who's a football historian, and we had a couple essays about football, but they were kind of existentially wrestling with football and should it exist and what if it didn't exist. And I said, I just want a bread and butter story about a football game. And he came up with, what if the Jets had lost Super Bowl III? So there was collaboration, and there was also just saying, hey, you're smart, go with it, both ways.
And we get into, by accident or by design, all kinds of interesting little alleys of history, economics, chemistry, the way international relations could have been changed. I guess this was maybe what you had in mind all along, but it ended up in some being a sort of serious and silly book at the same time.
Yes, I think the totality of the book has a lot of different flavors to choose from, and most of the chapters are bite-sized, to continue with the edibles analogy. But I definitely wanted to consider very funny chapters, and in fact, zanily funny chapters, like what if the basketballs were bigger than the rims, which is a John Boyce chapter that's a running transcript of Reggie Miller and Shaq debating why no one's ever scored in NBA history. But I also wanted to have chapters about history that you didn't know, asking what if the U.S. boycotted Hitler's Olympics, which Shira Springer wrote about brilliantly. And that's really more less about the Olympics and more about what the Olympics became and international relations. And what I very much wanted to do was there's a lot of different kinds of what ifs. And I had five different criteria. And the last is be funny. One was to posit a plausible counterfactual where you really convince the reader, oh, yeah, if that had happened, then these other things would happen. I was very eager just to teach people about history. I wanted to talk about society. The first chapter in the book is Lee Montville asking what if Muhammad Ali had gotten his draft deferment. And then the last one is I wanted to do what the sports fan does. And I think we heard that on the estimable WEEI radio, where they're asking, what if Malcolm Butler played? Now, here's the deal. Malcolm Butler was terrible during the season, and they didn't come – the Patriots, I know, didn't come that close. And the third argument against that being the kind of what if in the book is that you don't get any sympathy if you posit what if the Patriots won. Well, big deal. They win six Super Bowls instead of five. But still, I wanted to get into some of the historic what ifs that real sports fans have always wrestled over.
Well – we take a few stops by your home and my home, Brooklyn, New York, and speculate on the future of Flatbush Avenue and Atlantic Avenue, the Dodgers, the Nets, whoever ends up playing there. But nothing signals that it's time to claim your spot on the couch more than the playing of a network's football anthem. Here's Fox Sports. And joining me now from New York is Jason Gay, sports columnist for The Wall Street Journal. His essay for the book is What If Football Had Been Deemed Too Boring in 1899? How could it be with all that pseudo-militarism and brass? Jason Gay, welcome to the program.
Ray, thanks. Michael, how are you?
Thanks for coming on, Jason.
This is a reminder that that football was not a lead pipe cinch as America's game.
Oh, no. It was pretty boring. You know, turn of the century, and I mean 1899, this was a game that was, you know, just getting started with the forward pass. It wasn't very exciting. This was not the Tom Brady Philadelphia Eagles Super Bowl. Malcolm Butler or not.
And if you were sitting in the stands at, oh, I don't know, Harvard versus Yale, there was no neon yellow line showing you where the where the first down was. There were no cheerleaders. There were no... endless banks of statistics telling you how many times they convert to a first down in this situation.
No, there was not. There was no Beyonce halftime show either.
But no Cletus the Robot.
So you imagined this world where we have our weekends back. Take us to the book itself and give us a flavor of what you suggested. What you imagined.
Okay, this is going to be a reading, a candlelight reading from Michael's book. Okay, here we go. The lack of football would radicalize the American weekend, creating a giant pocket of freshly available time. Consider the modern football calendar. There are somewhere between a zillion and a zillion and a half college football games starting Wednesday, and running late into Saturday. Then on Sunday, the NFL kicks off with a garbage export game from London, followed by an afternoon to evening slate that swallows up the entire day until midnight Eastern. Now, if you're desperate or gambling, which I guess is the same thing, there's also Monday Night Football, and if you're lonely or questioning your existence, or perhaps a Jacksonville Jaguars fan, which I guess is the same thing, there's Thursday Night Football. Deprived of these events, the American calendar dramatically loosens up. The hopeful assumption is that American productivity, or at least active time, would surge. No longer couch-bound, the country would be free to rake leaves, prune hedges, fix plumbing, go on hikes, learn second languages, perhaps third languages, build a working rocket ship in the backyard out of popsicle sticks, go to church, or even read books. But a thought. Is it possible that football has been the only thing that has activated our brains on weekends, and without it, we'd be even more slothful, more prone to day drinking and couch napping? It's something to consider.
Now, the invention of the forward pass, the changing of the rules, some of it spearheaded by President Theodore Roosevelt.
That's true.
Helps bring football into the modern era. But wouldn't it have just been something else, some other game that would have scratched our itch and help us satisfy that sports jonesing?
Well, when we look at the popularity of football in America in, you know, the 21st century, we sort of do a little bit of social reverse engineering. Why is it so crazy? Why are people so obsessed? And I think part of it is that it is a once-a-week affair. You know, granted, there are a lot of people who watch a lot more than just one football game. But the pace of it is suited to sort of American leisure time. It is something you can kind of catch up with on the week. You can sort of get yourself excited to as the weekend turns. It's also built just majestically for television. There's only about 9.5 to 11 minutes of actual action in an NFL game. The rest of it is just sitting around watching people get lined up and so on and so forth. The commercials are baked into it. It's perfect for running to the kitchen to get something to eat or, you know, having to go to the restroom. It is not something that requires your utmost attention. So a game that was created not for television turns out to be perfect for our 21st century entertainment economy.
And perfect, it might be said, for what-ifs, because even during the off-season, you can switch around on your remote and see an hour-long talk show about the NFL called something like the NFL This Week in July, where there's nothing to talk about.
Well, they would argue there is lots to talk about. I mean, come on, right? You know, we can go deep. Let's go into the 6-round picks of all these franchises in the most recent draft. That is at least several hours worth of talk. All of these sports have done this. We used to have seasonal sports. You'd get warmed up in baseball when the clock turned and we'd start seeing, you know, sun in the sky. Football now is a 12-month affair. Baseball, there's the hot stove. Basketball, people are telling you now that the free agency or over the 4th of July weekend is bigger than the NBA Finals. I'm not into it as much.
Jason Gay's essay is, "What if football had been deemed too boring in 1899? Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mike Pesca, stick with us. We're discussing the greatest what-if moments in sports history. You can join the conversation. Here's one to consider. What if the National League had the DH. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. So what if Bill Walton had healthy knees? What if football were reinvented in the 21st rather than being a game from the 19th century? We're talking about the greatest what-if moments in sports history. You can join the conversation. What's the game? The shot? The race you play over and over again in your mind and imagine a different outcome? And why does it matter? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Mike Pesca, author of the new book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. And there's an all-star group of contributors to the book. Actor Jesse Eisenberg's What If looks at the reasons why the Phoenix Suns, in the last seconds of Game 6 of the championship series against the Chicago Bulls, lost the game and the championship. Could it be because of a letter that Jesse Eisenberg wrote as a fourth grader to one of the Suns' players? The full essay is in the book. Here's Eisenberg reading from the Companion podcast.
Dear Mr. Marley, I am a big fan of you. You're my favorite player. And I know that one day we will both be playing as teammates on the Phoenix Suns. I know how to draw the logo, and I'm a great dribbler. But I am really in trouble right now, and you're the only one who could help me.
Joining me now in the studio is Shira Springer, sports and society reporter right here at WBUR. Her essay is entitled, What If the United States Had Boycotted Hitler's Olympics? Shira, it's great to have you here.
Great to be here.
Is this as big a what if as all that? Weren't there some people arguing against going to Germany?
Yes, there were a lot of people arguing against going to Germany. In fact, the vote that the AAU took in December of 1935 was really, really close. And that's what sort of intrigued me about this topic. If two delegates had voted the other way, then I think the United States would have been on a path for boycotting the 1936 Olympics rather than attending.
Some of these what ifs, and I include yours in there, had outcomes that were in the realm of the plausible, and sometimes I didn't know whether they were complete inventions or actually had some shot at happening. And when you talked about the People's Games and an alternate Olympics in 1936, was that something that had been actively talked about back then?
Yeah, I mean, you hit upon one of the things that I loved about this project was the idea of writing something that was actually really plausible and using real events, real parts of history, real historical figures. And so you mentioned the People's Olympiad. That was an actual event that was supposed to take place in Barcelona. It was organized as a multi-sport event and as sort of a protest against the 1936 Nazi Games. And what ended up happening was on the eve of those games, the Spanish Civil War broke out and they had to cancel those games. So in my reimagined history, I propose that the United States, if it had boycotted the 1936 Games, would have then staged another version of the People's Olympiads, and it would have sort of been a barnstorming games. You know, they would have held different events throughout the United States and called it the People's Olympiad.
You know, a People's Olympiad in the context of the 1930s sounds very Lincoln Brigade, IWW, WPA. It just sounds a little too progressive for a guy like Avery Brundage.
And it would have been pretty progressive. You're probably right, too progressive for a guy like Avery Brundage. My gosh, what to say about Avery Brundage? He was the president of the IOC for 20 years, something that doesn't happen in my reimagined history. And he was a guy who was widely known for being racist, anti-Semitic. He was sexist. And in my opinion and in my essay, I believe he set the Olympic movement on a path that was pretty dangerous and got us to where we are today, which is an Olympic Games of excess, where it's more invested in pageantry and fanfare than in actual sports, and has sort of lost some of the original ideals of what the Olympics were supposed to be about or the Olympic movement was supposed to be about.
But the wonderful thing about alternate history is that you get to move him aside.
I do. And I get to seize upon one of my favorite figures in the essay, Judge Jeremiah T. Mahoney, who was just this undiscovered or perhaps underappreciated historical figure. He was a judge. He was also somebody who was vehemently opposed to sending a U.S. team to the Olympics. And he spoke out about it everywhere he could. And he was also president of the AAU at the time. And so he had a very big voice and a very big platform. And in my essay, it starts out with him actually successfully rallying the AAU delegates to boycott the Olympics. And he becomes sort of one of the heroes of this whole saga.
It also leavens the book, you know, for every invention of a time machine so that the Golden State Warriors can go back and play great NBA teams of the past, we have something that we're reminded of how sports can sometimes be a hinge point in history. Now, granted, I think sometimes the 1936 games are oversold, but there is some, I think, legit argument that this was a window onto Nazi Germany, the success of the Hitler regime, which at this point was still only a few years old, a country that had been plunged into hyperinflation and underemployment, now with everyone working and a humming economy. This was the shop window of Nazism to the world.
Yeah, I mean, this was
put it this way, Hitler didn't immediately recognize what it would mean for Nazi Germany to host the Olympics. He had to sort of be convinced. He didn't want what he considered racially pure athletes mixing with non-racially pure athletes. But when Goebbels, you know, saw the propagandistic value of the games, he said, we've got to do it, and we've got to do it big. So this was, don't forget, 3 years after Hitler came to power, and it was really, I think, the first time they recognized the full weight of their propaganda, you know, what they could do, not just in Germany, but internationally to spread what they considered, you know, to spread the ideology of Nazi Germany, to give to as broad an audience as possible.
Want to be reminded? Watch Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia. Shira Springer's essay, What If the United States Had Boycotted Hitler's Olympics? Shira, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Pesca is still with me. And Michael is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ray. I just wanted to bring in another perspective from the athlete side, because I played sports up into the professional level. And I wanted to remind everyone that the woulda, shoulda, couldas are great conversation for sports writers and for fans. But as an athlete, you can never live in the past. It would eat you alive. The only way you ever succeed is in the present. So I just wanted to bring that into the conversation, too.
Ah, so you're making a very important distinction, I think, Michael, because these what-ifs are actually what animates conversations, debates about, well, what if this player from one era had gotten to play against, you know, what if Bob Gibson had had to pitch against, you know, Sammy Sosa, so on. You're saying that you'd go crazy if you actually are one of the players reliving these moments.
If you're pitching and I'm hitting, I'm worried about what you're pitching next. If I'm worried about what you threw me last game or 2 years ago, I've already lost.
Michael, thanks a lot for your call. Mike Pesca, a good reminder of how different this is from the vision of the athlete.
Well, I do think there are a lot of essays in the book that an athlete would take heart with. First of all, Nate Jackson is a former Denver Bronco, and he wrote the essay, What If Football Were Reinvented Today? And there are a lot of essays, whereas I would not recommend, especially while in the active pursuit of sport, the athlete to be second-guessing himself. You do look at game film. You do study past tendencies. And there are a lot of essays, I think, that maybe bring deliverance to some athletes who have been underappreciated, or point out the fact that what we think was inevitable, and this isn't only in sports what-ifs. This is there every time we say a what-if historically. What we think was inevitable wasn't. So many times the athlete that we may think of as the GOAT, well, that's the place he always will have in our imagination. But please reconsider, but for that one player, one decision, or one piece of vagary of fate, that GOAT could be a hero. Or in fact, that hero could be, you know, the name on the lips of everyone who rues the day. That Stefan Fatsis essay about Bucky Dent homering over the Green Monster. He did it. Let us not take any credit from him. But what would have happened if he hadn't? And what would have happened if Drew Bledsoe hadn't gotten hurt? And then Tom Brady, who we see as this inevitable, perhaps all-time greatest football player, if not quarterback. Well, it wasn't inevitable. And I do think an athlete, especially when their legacy gets cemented, I do think perhaps we unfairly punish athletes. On the cover of the book is Bill Buckner, and we show him actually fielding the ball cleanly at first base. We also have Dwight Clark missing the catch and Charles Barkley raising a finals trophy, which he never won the finals. But, you know, imagine all the guff that Buckner took. And if we just said for a second, you know, that was a pretty chance act. What if he had just had 100 other times to field that ball, and he fields it cleanly, and he becomes a hero to Boston sports fans everywhere?
Joining us now from Greenwich, Connecticut, is Claude Johnson, founder and director of the Black Fives Foundation, which highlights the history of African Americans in basketball before the creation of the NBA. His essay for the book is called What If Nat Sweetwater Clifton's Pass Hadn't Gone Awry? Claude Johnson, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ray, thanks for having me on. And hi, Mike.
Hi, Claude.
Let's remind people that Nat Sweetwater Clifton was one of the first African Americans to play in the NBA. Here's why.
That's New York's Sweetwater Clifton. Hits that shot, is good.
Clifton drives through hard to ring up two. Clifton with a perfect set shot. Once more Clifton, and this one he gets.
Claude Johnson, this was a story I had never heard of before, and I'm a better man for having read it.
Oh,
tell
you.
People about Nat Clifton.
Well, Nat Clifton was a unique and unusual character in the history of basketball. He's an African-American player. He played with numerous teams prior to joining the Knicks, and this chapter that I wrote has to do with one specific play in one specific overlooked game that I feel plausibly changed the trajectory and the history of not only NBA, but all of basketball.
Give us your selection from your essay.
Okay. Time was running out when suddenly Sonny Woods stole the ball. Turning, he spotted Clifton, who had been guarding the pivot spot and was now racing up the middle of the court. Woods hit Clifton with a pass in stride, and instantly the big Wren center was in the middle of a three-on-one fast break with two teammates streaking up ahead to his left and to his right in perfect position to tie the game. This was textbook basketball, as basic as a two-handed chest pass taught to six-year-olds first learning the game. But what happened next stunned everyone in the stadium. Clifton, the sure-handed, fundamentally sound, undemonstrative center, threw a behind-the-back pass straight out of bounds. Behind his back? What? Now it was the Lakers' ball, with only seconds left in the game. They inbounded to Mikan, who iced it with another field goal for the win. Final score, Minneapolis 75, New York 71. The Lakers were world champions.
Reminding us that the Lakers came from a place, Minneapolis, where there actually were lakes, as opposed to Los Angeles, where there are none. Why was this such a pivotal moment?
Well, the NBA was formed the following year, and they chose teams from the National Basketball League and from the National Basketball Association of America. That year, the NBL had one struggling team that they replaced with the New York Wrens. But unfortunately, that New York Wrens team became the Dayton Wrens and had to assume the losing record of that replaced franchise. So, if they had won this championship, because by the way, if they had not thrown away the pass, that no turnover, I posit that they could have tied the game and won the game, even if it went into overtime because they had momentum. And if they had had this championship, they wouldn't have been in a position to have accepted this kind of poor positioning in the NBL, and they would have easily won the NBL championship, and then they wouldn't have been it wouldn't have been so easy and probably impossible to leave them out of becoming a founding member of the NBA. So I think that if this one pass hadn't gone out of bounds, the NBA would have had an all-black touring professional basketball team, the New York Wrens, as a founding member.
In the biggest media market and biggest city in the country, not in Dayton.
Absolutely.
Did that retard the development of black players in the NBA? I mean, when you think back, there were great NBA stars, even in the earliest lace-up sneakers, short shorts era. You had the Oscar Robertsons and so on. Did this change the trajectory of the black player in the league?
I say yes, because what happened next is that it took another year after 1949 for the NBA to actually sign its three first African-American players. Sweetwater Clifton was one of them. Earl Lloyd was the other, and Chuck Cooper was the third. But there were many other players. You know, if you can imagine, all right, here you have this founding franchise, and probably within a year they would have made trades to strengthen their team. They had a really savvy owner. His name is Robert Bob Douglas. He's in the Basketball Hall of Fame. He would have made trades with white players,
European players, Jewish players, you know, Irish players, whatever he could get, and vice versa. So there would have been a lot more opportunity in the league. The league owners would have been much more open to saying, okay, fine, let's go, and the floodgates would have opened. So, but what happened instead is that they signed these three players. There was a fourth player signed, Hank DeZonnie. He didn't last very long, and it took a while for, let's say, a critical mass to come into the league. So, yeah, I think it retarded the development of African-American players in the NBA for quite some time. But what happened, sort of as a counterweight to that, is that black colleges and universities started, you know, strengthening their conferences, and the fork in the road was also there for the Harlem Globetrotters to take off. Abe Saperstein, a brilliant marketer, but also an exploiter of his players, took his team to Europe and all around. So there were definitely it was a huge fork in the road.
Yeah, well, if the New York Wrens had taken off, as the way your counter history posits, we might not have had the Harlem Globetrotters. We might not have needed the Harlem Globetrotters. Claude Johnson, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Claude Johnson's essay is What If Nat Sweetwater Clifton's Pass Hadn't Gone Awry? Mike Pesca, stick with us. We're talking about the greatest what-ifs in sports history. After the break, we'll consider what if Richard Nixon had been good at football? Think about that and give us your big what-if sports moment. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
There's nothing like a movie theater on a hot day, and there's nothing like a good show you can binge watch with a cold glass of lemonade. Summer is the perfect time to find your next favorite thing, and Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. Find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're imagining how the world would change if a play, trade, injury, or ref's call had just gone the other way. You can join the conversation. What if Muhammad Ali had gotten his draft deferment? What if Title IX was never signed? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Mike Pesca, author of the new book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Baltimore, Maryland is our next stop. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. So coming from Maryland and as an alumni of the University of Maryland, my what if is what if Len Bias had not died and had been a Boston Celtic as he was intended to be? I think it would have changed the entire course of the NBA and possibly, who knows, if Michael Jordan would still be considered the greatest basketball player of all time.
It certainly would have changed the competitive balance in the league at that moment when Bias was coming on. But, of course, you have to assume there that he would live up to his promise, Brian. It sounds like you believe that he would have.
Well, there's no reason to doubt it. I mean, given his college career, he was outstanding. And, of course, there's injuries and everything, but there was nothing that showed that his talent was not going to, you know, live up to what it should have been. I mean, of course, Michael Jordan is extraordinary and can't argue that, but I mean, whether Len Bias would be considered better or not, it definitely would have made the Bulls run more difficult.
Joining us from New York is Julian Zelizer. His day job is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. His essay for the book is called What If Nixon Had Been Good at Football? Julian, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Why is that such a pivotal moment?
Well, it's fun to look back at the personality of a president and how it was shaped. Nixon was notoriously shy, awkward, angry, and paranoid. And so I wondered a little bit, what if he had been good at the sport he really loved and he played, football, and had been much better at it than he actually was? Would it have changed his character and maybe changed the course of presidential politics?
President Richard Nixon was a third stringer on the Whittier College football team. In a 1983 interview with reporter Frank Gannon, Nixon spoke about the life lessons he learned from Coach Wallace, Chief Newman.
You play to win, and if you don't win, you kick yourself in the butt and be sure you don't make the same mistakes again. He drilled that into us, and I must say I was affected, and I would say hundreds of others who came under the chief, just by the character of the man, the strength of the man. I was never any good at it, but I learned a lot sitting by him on the bench.
We'd like to thank the University of Georgia for providing that tape to us. Julian, what do you hear in that reminiscence that could have changed the course of history if Nixon was really good?
Well, this coach, Newman, had a really big effect and taught him all kinds of sayings and lessons that he took with him about getting up when you were down and about playing the hardest you could. But the last part of the interview where he says I was always on the bench is really kind of the most important. I mean, Nixon loved football, but he really wasn't good at it. He really wasn't built at it. He was put on the field for practice. He was put on only when the team was far ahead. And this was one of his dreams that was unfulfilled. And this is an important part of his life as a young man in high school and in college that I do think had an effect on him. Obviously, there were many other parts that went into the Nixonian mix. But that line, sitting on the bench, tells you a lot about Nixon.
We have had the experience of people who were successes in public life and at football. Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Byron Whizzer White. Gerald Ford was a standout player at the University of Michigan. They seem to have been balanced, happy people in a lot of ways.
That's true. And Ronald Reagan also was a pretty good player. Mo Udall, Jack Kemp. It gave them a level of confidence and sense of self that I think was important to who they became as adults. And so those contrasts are just interesting when you look at someone who had a very different sports trajectory early on.
So I'm trying to imagine Nixon otherwise from who he turned out to be. Are you thinking of someone who's a little less paranoid, a little less angry, a little less resentful of the stars and the big men on campus? Does that change who he becomes as an adult?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's the game, so to speak. And the more you study about Nixon, the more striking his personality is. It's pretty consistent throughout his life. He's always imagining that other people are doing better than him, that other people are more loved than him, and that somehow he'll be the one who gets the short end of the stick. I mean, this is part of his life at every single stage. It obviously culminates in the way he runs his presidency and a rather ruthless approach that he has towards his opponents and a total paranoia about everyone, even his closest aides. This was fundamental to who he was. He was also incredibly shy. His biographer, Evan Thomas, talks about this, and that affected the way he dealt with his inner circle. So all of this was it's interesting to imagine, what if he had been very different? What if he had really had a good sense of who he was and a confidence in what he could do, so you didn't have to be breaking into the Watergate to win. Instead, you could just go out front in front of the crowds and wow them.
And Ray, if I may,
sure.
In our podcast, episode one was this essay, What If Nixon Were Good at Football? And it was reported by, because the podcast isn't just reading from the book, we have reporters and sound designers do the essays so that they become their own thing. Leon Nafak of Slow Burn reported out this great essay. And he, this is so interesting, he not only gets into everything Julian was talking about, but Nixon's playbook at Whittier, when he was a Whittier poet, he founded a club for the forgotten man on the team, because there was one club for the halfbacks and the quarterbacks, and they were the alphas of the campus. And he recognized that the linemen and the lunch bucket guys were ignored. And that playbook has absolute resonance with how he governed and how he campaigned. It's really amazing.
It's like the silent majority, right? Right at college already.
And Whittier, it's a pretty small school, right? I mean, Richard Nixon wouldn't have come to us the way Gerald Ford did. He played in the Rose Bowl, if I'm remembering this correctly, Gerald Ford. I mean, yes, the unglamorous center, but the center did a lot more in those days. Whittier is a pretty small college. Richard Nixon wouldn't have come to us, come to national prominence as a good football player at Whittier, would he?
Right. I don't think there was a great chance of him being a superstar NFL player down the road. It's not an essay about, you know, what if Nixon was Tom Brady? I think instead it's more about what his personality would have been like had he had a different experience as a young man. And that's really the question so much as his trajectory in sports. Obviously, if somehow he made Whittier into a landmark team and went into sports, then the entire history of American politics would have been different.
Julian Zelizer from Princeton University, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Chesapeake, Virginia is next. Jay is on the line. Jay, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Ray. I'm a big fan of women's tennis, and the question to me has always been, what if Monica Seles was never stabbed in the back at a tennis tournament in Germany by a deranged Steffi Graf fan?
Mike Pesca, a good what if?
Yes, it's definitely a good what if, because the ripples of that are not just who would have won tournaments or how this would have affected the rise of other players, but it talks – what I would do, you know, if someone pitched that to me, I would focus on things like the fan experience and how professional sports matches have now become sort of lockdown sites with being scanned when you enter, and how there's now a greater separation between the fan and the player. I remember when I was a kid, people would run onto the field at all times. And now, and I think Seles was a huge inflection point as far as that goes, beyond the tennis. So this is where the creativity of it comes in. And to go back to Len Bias, I just want you to know that was the number one essay that people ask me about. And I do think he would have made the Celtics a better team. They won the championship the year he was drafted. But I found it difficult. I did not want to be frivolous with a man's life. And I did not want to posit, of course he would have been good or engaged in that. Maybe he wouldn't have been that good counterfactuals because he did die. So I just never found that I could have gotten the tone right, first of all. And the second thing is, it is less joyful when you talk about one of the storied franchises in a sport and just giving them more championships. And that's what happens if you say, oh yeah, the Celtics win two more.
Nashville, Tennessee is next. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. A lot of what-ifs in boxing. And one of the big ones, of course, is Muhammad Ali. What if he had, had not been banned from boxing when over his draft status? So that's subject to a lot of speculation. And again, I'm going to have to read Mike's book. That's great, great topic. Thanks,
and
Ray.
And a chapter on that specific thing, Mike Pesca.
Yeah, Lee Monfil, who wrote the chapter, does, of course, concede that without the interregnum, without him effectively being banned by the sport, his record is better. However, I think it's really compelling. The basic thesis is Ali doesn't become Ali. Ali doesn't become the cultural touchstone because without this imposed martyrdom, he doesn't become the person he is, and we don't perceive him as the person he is. This is his greatest challenge, and the way he dealt with that challenge made the person who essentially became a secular saint. So maybe would have won a few more matches, but he wouldn't have become the greatest of all time.
See, I argued with that chapter from beginning to end because by losing those years at the peak of his career, he fought later into his life and at a slower pace. He was a slower man later in his career, yeah, and took a lot more punishment, so became the silent, stone-faced Parkinson's syndrome man that we saw late in his life. Instead, he might have been a bubbling, effervescent presence without the scrambled brains. It's interesting to speculate about, but that's the whole book. Mike Pesca,
that's
thanks
the whole
a lot.
Book. You're welcome.
Mike Pesca is host of the Slate podcast, The Gist, and author of Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. In a moment, Olympian and World Cup player Abby Wambach on fighting back against the gender pay gap in sports and beyond. It's On Point. Last Wednesday at Barnard College's commencement in New York, retired soccer star Abby Wambach told graduates about receiving ESPN's inaugural Icon Award alongside basketball's Kobe Bryant and football's Peyton Manning. She was grateful to be there, she said, in the company of Kobe and Peyton. that women had finally made it. But as the applause ended, she realized that she and the two male athletes were stepping into very different futures.
Each of us, Kobe, Peyton, and I, we made the same sacrifices. We shed the same amount of blood, sweat, and tears. We'd left it all on the field for decades with the same ferocity, talent, and commitment. But our retirements wouldn't be the same at all. Because Kobe and Peyton walked away from their careers with something I didn't have. Enormous bank accounts. And because of that, they had something else I didn't have. Freedom. Their hustling days were over, and mine were just beginning. Later that night, back in my hotel room, I laid in bed and thought, this isn't just about me, and this isn't just about soccer. We talk a lot about the pay gap. We talk about how we, overall, U.S. women, earn 80 cents for every dollar paid to men. Black women in America earn 63 cents, while Latinas earn 54 cents for every dollar paid to white men. What we need to talk more about is the aggregate and compounding effects the pay gap on women's lives. Over time, the pay gap means women are able to invest less and save less, so they have to work longer. When we talk about what the pay gap costs us, let's be clear. It costs us our very lives. And it hit me that I'd spent most of my time during my career the same way I'd spent my time on that ESPY stage, just feeling grateful. Grateful to be one of the only women to have a seat at the table. I was so grateful to receive any respect at all for myself that I often missed opportunities to demand equality for all of us. But as you know, women of Barnard, change is here. Women are learning that we can be grateful for what we have and also demand what we deserve. Like all little girls, I was taught to be grateful. I was taught to keep my head down, stay on the path, and get my job done. I was freaking Little Red Riding Hood. You know the fairy tale. It's just one iteration of the warning stories girls are told the world over. Little Red Riding Hood heads off to the woods and is given strict instructions. Stay on the path. Don't talk to anybody. Keep your head down, hidden underneath your handmaid's tail cape. And she does, at first. But then she dares to get a little curious, and she ventures off the path. That's, of course, when she encounters the big bad wolf, and all hell breaks loose. The message is clear. Don't be curious. Don't make trouble. Don't say too much, or bad things will happen. I stayed on the path out of fear, not of being eaten by a wolf, but of being cut, being benched, losing my paycheck. If I could go back and tell my younger self one thing, it would be this. Abby, you were never Little Red Riding Hood. You were always the wolf.
Abby Wambach speaking to Barnard College graduates in New York. For a video and transcript of her event, go to our website at onpointradio.org. On Point's produced by Anna Bowman, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Cozzonis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Raleigh, Jeremy Riosa, and James Ross. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Ray Suarez. It's On Point.